Wistful Thinking is brought to you by the Cage Club Podcast Network. For all things movie and nostalgia podcasts, go to cageclub.me. That's cageclub.me.
The real charm of it lay in Beth's happy face as she leaned over the new piano and lovingly touched the beautiful black and white keys. During the next few minutes, the rumor circulated that Amy March had got 24 delicious lines.
I told you they dressed me up, but I didn't tell you that they powdered and squeezed and made me look a fashion plate.
As she spoke, Jo took off her bonnet. A general outcry arose, for all her abundant hair was cut short.
Jo, how could you? You're one beauty.
Nothing's going to change, Jo.
Welcome to Wistful Thinking, a podcast where we revisit pop culture from our youth to see if it's still as good all grown up. I'm Kara Gale O'Regan, and with me, as always, is my co-host, Jordan Poland Clark.
Hi.
And today we're going to be talking about the 1995 film adaptation of the Louisa May Alcott novel, Little Women. This was very important to both of us when we were growing up. And there was a lot of crying that happened.
Much crying.
Jordan, what was your relationship to this movie?
Well, okay, so was it you or me who brought this movie up first?
You know what? I think it's like come up a few times when we've been talking about other things. And then you were talking about it. And then I read a really good essay about it, and then we were like, let's just do Little Women.
Right, okay, so the reason I was talking about it is because we were talking about, like, well, maybe we don't need a guest every time, maybe, like, we should just pick things. So I was like, okay, what would I pick? And I was like, I would pick Austin Powers. I used to watch that movie, like, every day. And then I was like, wait, no, I used to alternate it with Little Women. I used to watch Little Women all the time, like, probably as much as I watched Austin Powers. So
which is such a good combo.
I have really good taste. And I just have this like, you know, do you ever get the thing in your life where, like, you had a really close friend who you have memories of, but, like, they're related to things that you used to, like, do or watch together?
Yeah.
So I have this, like, very, like, vivid sound of my best friend's voice, my best friend from growing up. She was my best friend till we were in, like, seventh grade, and then she moved away. And there's a line in this movie where Jo is feeding Beth broth, which we'll talk about so much later because we're going to get to that scene. But she says, drink this good broth. My friend used to say that.
Oh, God, I'm crying already.
But, like, that, like, just that line alone is, like, seared in my head. I can hear her voice so clearly saying that line. So, I don't know, yeah. I love this, but I, like, really, really hadn't seen it at all since I was a kid. I hadn't even really thought about it, and, like, maybe didn't even realize how important it was to me until I turned it on again now. And I was like, what? This is everything.
Yeah. I watched it a bunch as a kid, too. Maybe not that much, but it was something that I saw a bunch and definitely have not seen as an adult. And it was this essay called Home is Where the Hurt Is that was on that Bright Wall, Dark Room, which is a film blog by Asher Geltzer Gavados. And it's really good. I actually had to stop reading it because it was making me cry. And then I was just like, oh my God, I have to watch this movie again. Because it, like, all of this stuff, like, came rushing back. And, yeah, watching it again was, whew, it was a doozy. So, before we get into that, this plot of Little Women, or the synopsis, is that, at least when the movie opens, their father, it's about the... My brain's all
do
over.
Do you want me to try?
Yep. Please do.
Okay. It's about the March family, which is made up of a mother, a father, and four daughters. And when the movie opens...
But mostly just a mother and four daughters.
Well, when the movie opens, the father is away. He's at the Civil War. I don't remember what he's doing.
I think he was fighting.
No, I don't think he was fighting because he's old. He was doing something else.
Oh, yeah.
But so their father is absent for most of the movie. So the movie follows these young women who are, I think, aged between like 12 and 17. Does that sound right?
Yeah, that sounds right.
As they, I would describe it as struggle with being women. You know, during that time period.
You know, a classic coming-of-age story.
But, you know, their personalities are so, so, so developed, mm-hmm. and including the mother. And that's, I mean, that's the
played
best part.
Played by a pre-problematic Susan Sarandon, who is amazing in this movie.
Why is she problematic?
Oh, she said some things in the past year or so, like, politically, they're just, you know, not great. They're not great, but...
Oh.
Let's not let the let us get derailed by that.
The movie stars Susan Sarandon as the mother. I don't know the name of the actress who plays Meg, who's the oldest sister, because was she ever in anything again? Who is that?
100% thought that was Andie MacDowell. Like,
oh, I could see
well
that.
Well into the movie, I think I wrote down notes about her and was like, Andie MacDowell's hair. And even when I thought about, like, rewatching this, I was like, oh, man, and that cast, Susan Sarandon's got Winona Ryder, it's got Andie MacDowell. It's not Andie MacDowell. Her name is...
It's Trini Alvarado.
Yes. She's been in some other things, but I think...
Not like the other actresses have.
No.
So
no,
she's
like the
oldest sister.
The girl
who
that played Christy in Babysitter's Club, who, like, looked exactly at the same time looked like... Anna Paquin. I think that happens a lot. Where there's like two actresses that look exactly alike.
That
and
does happen.
One of them goes on into fame. Although Amy Adams and all the other ones seem to have been doing well.
Yeah.
Like there's like four women that look like her. I have no idea who they are.
No,
anyway.
One of them's Isla Fisher and she's also great. And they look exactly the same. They're definitely, like, people think they're the same person. Okay, anyway.
I think she's married to Borat, right?
Yes. okay, so... Trini Alvarado plays Meg, who is the oldest sister, who's meant to be, like, 17, maybe. And she's kind of the one who, like, I would say plays by the rules of the time period the most. Like, she kind of isn't, like, dreaming of this big life. She kind of just, like, wants to do the right thing and fit in and, like, have a nice husband. And they all believe in marrying for love. I think that's a really, really important plot point that will come up over and over again. The next oldest is played by Winona Ryder. That's Jo. And she's,
I
like...
I think this is my favorite of her roles over the years.
I think so, too.
Yeah. She's so good in this.
Yeah, and it's, like, it's the same thing, like, where I can, like, hear her voice, like, echoing in my head still. Mm-hmm. Like, because I... I just watched it so much. But so she's, like, the protagonist mostly, like, I mean, you really, like, learn a lot and hang out a lot with all of the sisters, but you spend the most time with Jo.
Yeah, and it's, like, from her, like, there's voiceover and stuff, and it's her.
It's her, yeah.
And it's her, you ultimately understand, I think, her writing about this experience, retrospectively. Kind of. They play with that a little bit, but.
Yeah. So.
She's the narrator.
And she's feisty, and kind of a tomboy, and has a temper that she's always trying to control because it gets her in trouble. The next one is Beth, who's played by Claire Danes, who is, like, super soft-spoken and, like, just wants everyone to be happy and, like, wants everyone to be together. She's, like, the traditional, like, youngest sibling, even though she's not the youngest sibling.
Yeah.
Then,
I feel like she's, like, one half of the traditional younger sibling, and then... The next sister embodies that other half.
Is the other half? Yeah, so the next sister is Amy, who's played by Kirsten Dunst. And then what's the name of the actress who plays her when she's older?
Samantha Mathis.
Yeah.
Kirsten Dunst is amazing in this too.
Yeah, so she plays young Amy, and then Amy grows up because we have a 4-year time skip in the movie. But so Amy is like super, not spoiled, but she acts spoiled kind of. She's just like very much the baby. And she's just always dreaming of like being glamorous and like being in love and having this like amazing life, you know? And she's an artist, which like I don't think they establish well enough in this movie until the end. Like I didn't get really at all in the beginning that she was an artist, but whenever you read about the character, she is described as an artist.
Well, because there is that scene where she's sitting in the garden painting teacups, I think you're to understand that like kind of all of the sisters are artists, you know, because they have that like newspaper that they publish together.
Yeah, that's true.
They like put on skits and stuff like that. So I think like all of them are intensely creative and you don't really see her start to come into her own until after that 4-year time skip and like we're introduced to old, quote unquote, old Amy. She's sitting in the garden painting a teacup and a snotty art teacher is making rude comments about her to her Aunt March. And then she goes to Paris with her and she's studying art there.
Yeah. So I guess then the other two characters who matter are Aunt March, who's their old aunt, who first Joe is the caretaker of her and then Amy becomes her caretaker. And so Amy gets to go to Europe with her, which is something that Joe always wanted to do, but Amy gets to do it instead.
I think it's important to note that their Aunt March seems to be very wealthy, whereas, like, the family, and they make comments about this multiple times, they have very little money.
But they used to have money. I've never read the book, which I'm regretting now. But
it's good. It's a book that I, like, read multiple times as a kid.
Everything I read about it, though, said that they used to have money and their dad got them in debt. And so now they don't have any money, except then they actually take care of a lot of people who truly don't have any money. So like they're fine, you know, they don't have what they used to have, but like they're not dirt poor. Because you see people in this movie who really are dirt poor because they're taking, they still go out of their way to take care of other people. So then the other character that matters a bunch is Laurie.
Ugh.
What?
Oh, is that not your reaction to Laurie? Because I think he is the worst.
I don't, and then I do.
Okay, that's fair. That's fine.
I have mixed feelings about him. So he's played by Christian Bale. And he moves in. So he like had this childhood where he's from a very wealthy family, and his father married an Italian woman, a musician or an artist or something.
And the rumor that Joe cites is that he was reared in Italy among artists and vagrants.
Yes. But so both of his parents have now passed away, so he comes home to live with his grandfather, who is the next-door neighbor of the March family. So they get to know him, and he becomes kind of like an unofficial member of the March family. Although I guess eventually he becomes an actual member of the March family.
Mm-hmm. And also, Gabriel Byrne is in it doing his best Werner Herzog impression.
Yeah, I like him in this.
Friedrich, who ultimately wins the heart of Joe.
And then who's the guy who marries Meg? He's been in other
Eric
stuff.
Stoltz.
Yeah.
Yeah, he was in.
He's in stuff. Right.
And other stuff.
And other stuff. You know, it's one of those guys whose face you know, but.
Yeah.
Is that it? Did we get everybody?
Their
father.
Maybe
their father
more or
comes
less.
Home eventually and it's like
yeah,
kind
but
of
he's
isn't
like,
involved.
I don't even think he has any speaking lines in the movie, does
barely,
he?
Barely.
Yeah.
He, like, says hello to them all when he comes in after he's been wounded. He comes home, and so he talks to them then. And then, like, later he's there after Beth dies. Spoiler, Beth dies.
Yeah. So this movie, based on the book by Louisa May Alcott, who we actually talked about in the last episode. I don't know if you remember this, but when we were talking about Clueless, Cher went to Bronson Alcott High School, which was named for Louisa May Alcott's father.
Oh, yeah, we were talking about that.
Yeah, so he was like the founder of Transcendentalism or whatever, and hung out with people like Wordsworth and Thoreau and those guys. And so this book is like semi-autobiographical. It's not exactly, but Joe in the story is basically Louisa May Alcott, and the plot of it is based off of her life with her and her sisters, which is full of just joy and also a lot of loss, which I think is what makes this book and this movie, I mean this movie especially, what makes it so special is that it strikes this kind of perfect balance between those two things in something I like to call an emotional speedball.
It really is!
Because you're just like, you know, it's so visceral and so, like, for as gut-wrenching and sad as parts of this movie and parts of this story are, and actually parts of the story that happened in real life, like the true sense of joy and like love for each other really just shines through this movie. It's so good.
There's a line in it, in one part where Laurie is talking to Brooks, and he's like looking at them from the window, and he's like, what do you think they spend their time doing? Like, he's just wondering about them because, you know, these women are such a mystery to him. And I think that, like, this movie does a really good job of capturing what, like, young girls actually do.
And yeah, the rich inner lives of women, which we almost never get to see,
right?
On screen.
But, like, all that stuff where they're, like, making fake newspapers and, like, writing stuff and putting on plays. Like, I did all that with my friends.
Yeah.
That's real.
Yeah. These, like, really creative, willful, enterprising teen girls again. We know how much I love enterprising teen girls. Like, all of these things that, to a certain extent, are used as, like, almost weapons against young women. Mm-hmm. Like, especially, like, the willfulness and stuff like that. Like, we never get to see that portrayed really positively in this way that it's like, what do you think they do in there? Although, when you were saying that, it made me think of The Virgin Suicides, which is another film adaptation that Kirsten Dunst was in. But, yeah, like, you never get to see that kind of, like, inner life of young women or, you know, not young women. It's very rare. I think you're starting to see it more, but, like, it's not, for all of film history, not been something that gets explored a lot.
Yeah, and they're so affectionate with each other, too.
Yeah.
I feel like that's also not something, like, I don't even want to say that you don't see it, because you kind of do, but there's something about this movie where it seems so genuine. Like, I would describe most of it in other movies as being kind of artificial. And this just, like, feels so real. Maybe they're just, you know, the acting is that good.
Yeah. It was written by Robin Swicord. I'm not sure how you pronounce that.
Do you know what else she wrote?
Practical Magic.
I know.
Yes. I got really excited when I saw that, because that's another movie about, like, this richer inner life of, you know, this multi-generational, like, family of women. Sisterhood. It seems to be a very strong theme for her.
I don't think Practical Magic did, like, nearly as good a job as this did, though.
Of those things? Yeah, no, I think you're right. You're definitely right. But it was good.
The other thing that you touched on a little bit a few minutes ago, was, like, about loss. Like,
yeah.
I think the thing that really, really comes across for this whole movie is how close death always was.
Yeah.
During that time period. Like, I feel like we...
Up until very
recently. Like, we don't have to live like that, but, like, most people forever have had to live like that. And, like, yeah, it's just...
Yeah. One of the things that made me cry the hardest when I was researching which I had to take several cry breaks. But in real life, the character of Amy, who's the youngest daughter, the artist, or the youngest sister, I forget what her name was in real life, but she actually was like a pretty renowned artist in her own right. So Louisa May Alcott had gotten kind of famous, but also her youngest sister gained some notoriety as an artist herself. And, you know, got to live in Europe for a while and stuff like that. But then she had a child and then died 7 weeks later. And it's just like, ugh, man.
Yeah, just like kids dying. You know? There's a war, yeah. So like all the like men are dying. Like everyone's just dying. Time. Yeah.
Yeah.
And they're so graceful in this of like how they deal with that.
Mm-hmm. So Little Women has been adapted to the screen, I think, 2 or 3 other times.
Four times total.
Okay. There's 2 new ones coming up.
Yeah, there's 2 new ones? What's the
other
one?
There's 2. Yeah. We'll get to that.
Okay.
So this one is actually the first time that you see Beth die on screen, which is something that can be done really poorly, but is done so unbelievably well here. And it's like peak Claire Danes ugly cry face too.
There's really like spit in her mouth. You can see it. It's really perfect. Yeah.
Yeah. She's really good.
Yeah.
The sister that Beth is based on also, like that scene where she like goes to their neighbor's house and the baby is crying and she's like trying to help them and then she comes down with scarlet fever. That actually happened to her. And she like kind of recovered but never fully did and like didn't have great health. And then 2 years later died. So I think there's like a longer period of time in the movie where she gets to live after she had scarlet fever, but that actually is based on real life, which is also super sad.
Yeah. I also think that they do a good job of capturing how nasty girls are to each other too.
Yeah.
Like there's a part where Jo accidentally burns off Meg's hair.
Oh my god.
And then
that scene is like also burned into my memory.
And then they go out to like a party together, right? They're both there.
Yeah.
And I don't even remember why. I didn't write down why, but Jo is like a little bit jealous of Meg at the party for some reason. Like someone's flirting with her. There's some reason.
Well, I think because she just like she actually has been like taken on by the rich girl. There's actually a makeover scene in this movie, which I got really excited when I realized that. I was like, oh my god, it's a makeover scene. So like she's had this transformation and now she's like the belle of the ball and she's just getting a lot of attention.
That's later though, isn't it? Joe's not at that one because Meg is like, remember Meg is really embarrassed about it and she runs into Laurie and they make each other promise not to tell.
Mm-hmm.
So this is before that. I think Laurie's is like seeing how pretty he thinks Meg is, and so Jo says she's completely bald in front, which I thought was funny because she is the reason that Meg is bald in front. It's just like how girls sometimes, I don't know, maybe men do this too, but like girls like can't hold their tongue sometimes about, you know, gets a little catty. And then the part where Amy burns Joe's book.
Manuscript.
Oh my god.
It's really sad.
It's really sad.
It's also like Amy like clearly like immediately regretted it too. So it's just like really like sad. But the two of them I think have a really interesting relationship because they both are so creative. I think there's like a little bit of competition between them and also like I don't know, just like a weird dynamic because later on after like the time jump, Amy's the one that gets to go to Europe with their aunt, so Joe, and she always thought that she was going to be the one who goes. But so like to me their relationship is the most interesting, I think, but also has the most humor to it too. because of the way that they, like, speak to each other. Like, when Joe cuts off all of her hair, Amy exclaims, "Joe, your hair! It's your one beauty!" And I think that when you see it the first time, or when you hear it the first time in the movie, it just is like, oh my god, her hair. But then you hear it again later, like, Joe is furiously writing, and you, like, hear all of these, like, memories that she's having, and, like, you hear that one line, and it made me, like, bust out laughing hysterically, because it's so much funnier that time around.
Yeah. I think Joe is fun because nothing can be easy for her. Like, mm-hmm. She's the kind of person who never wants to take the easy way out, and in some ways will actually, like, take the hardest route on purpose.
Yeah.
Because she knows that that's the only thing that she needs to do. Mm-hmm. Which makes her so wise. And she doesn't know it. But it makes her so wise.
She's just kind of like, why is everything so hard?
Yeah.
Which I definitely understand. Can definitely identify with that. So, like I said, she based Joe on herself, Louisa May Alcott did. But Joe marries at the end of this story. Like, Friedrich comes to deliver, like, the bound copy of her book, and then they wind up together, which always kind of bummed me out. Like, I just wanted, like, because she is such a strong character, like, I didn't want that to be kind of, like, how it ended. And in real life, Louisa May Alcott never did actually marry. She explained her spinsterhood in an interview where she said, "I'm more than half persuaded that I am a man's soul out, put by some freak of nature into a woman's body, because I have fallen in love with so many pretty girls and never once the least bit with any man." So I, like, kind of wish that the ending was different, but otherwise, her, like, she never makes decisions based on, like, her love for a man, which I think is rad.
Well, that's definitely true, but I also don't think she ever really loved a man until she met Friedrich.
Yeah, no, that's definitely true.
She didn't love Laurie.
No.
I don't mind that ending.
Yeah.
Just because it's not forced. Like, everything that happens is, like, her own choice.
Right.
And
yeah, that's true.
She gets a lot of things that she wanted.
Yeah, that's true. And this is actually part of a trilogy. There's, like, two more books called Joe's Boys. Wait, no. Little Men and Joe's Boys. And I watched the beginning of, like, a low-budget Canadian state television adaptation of Little Men. And in that, it's, like, Friedrich had just died, and she was, like, trying to figure out how to run the school by herself.
Hmm.
So it sets that up.
I think, unfortunately, like, that was a time period where, like, if you wanted to do anything, you needed to be married. And so, like, the world wasn't going to stop her, so she needed to get married, you know?
Yeah.
Like, I think that was something that she was always pretty accepting of.
Yeah.
But she wasn't, like, Meg or, like, Amy, or, like, they kind of knew what they wanted. I don't think she knew what she wanted.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay, tell me why you ughed at Laurie.
Because he just sucks. I don't know. There were a few times that I made notes about this, so let me take a look.
I can tell you what some of mine are, because I have, like, two.
Okay.
I mean, one time I just wrote, "Laurie is the worst right now," but I'm not really sure why I wrote that. But the first thing that I thought was weird is when, so they have to send Amy away when Beth gets scarlet fever, because Amy's never had it, and they don't want her to catch it, so they send her away. And Laurie kind of escorts her, and so they're sitting in this carriage together, and she's worried that she's going to die. She's worried that she's already caught scarlet fever, and that she's not going to make it. And
at this scene, I wrote, "Ugh, get out of here, Christian Bale."
Yeah, right? Okay, so, yeah, because it's not awesome. So she's,
although,
like,
it could have gone much worse.
Definitely. But so she's, like, getting all dramatic because that's just what she does. And she's like, what if I die before I get to have a kiss? Like, nobody's ever going to kiss me. And Laurie is like, I promise to kiss you before you die. Which is, like, weird because she's, like, 12 and he's, like, 18.
Yeah.
Like, it's meant to be a sweet moment, and if you disregard a lot of things, it is. Like, his sentiment is nice. Like, I get what he's saying, but you can't just say that to a 12-year-old.
Right. Yeah. Oh, here we go. There's one point where he's, like, talking to... Oh, it's when he, like, professes his love for Joe, which I think is, like, right after Beth dies. She, like, goes running out into the woods, and then he, like, comes after her. And he's basically... Like, no, is that
it's,
two different scenes?
It's way before that. She does run out into the woods both times, but I think because he marries Amy after Beth dies. Right. He goes to find Amy after Beth dies, and they kiss, and then they go home.
Yeah, so...
I don't remember why she ran out in the woods that time.
Where she happened to be running out of, into the woods, which is, like, another way in which I identified deeply with this character, because that was my go-to, I'm frustrated move.
But she also, like, I feel like it's very symbolic, because she runs out into the woods, but always, like, comes to a gate where she has to stop. She never gets very far.
Oh, interesting. That is a very interesting point.
Yeah.
So he basically is like, why do you girls get to paint and write and I have to set my music aside and go work?
Oh, yeah. I also wrote this down. Yes. Yeah, and he's like acting like they're the same and they're not.
Right. Yeah. And so then he like professes his love to her and she just looks so terrified and annoyed and is like, what the fuck? And he says, you don't have to write unless you want to. And honestly, how dare you?
Right.
Sir. And she even says, like, I just can't go be your wife. Like, I can't give up who I am just to, like, go off and be the wife of some rich man. So that was pretty rad. And then there were a few more notes that I made about him.
Well, wait, can we talk about that scene for a second? Because sure. I wrote during that scene, like, about how wise both of them were during that scene. Like, because she's like, I can't just be a wife. Like, which was just, like, I don't know. I feel like that was a ballsy and really, really smart thing to say. And she's like, we'll kill each other. Here's all the reasons why this is a bad idea. And then once he, like, gets that that's what she's saying, because she's basically, she makes it sound like she's never going to get married. Mm-hmm. And he's like, no, you will. He's like, you'll meet someone who you actually love, and you will.
Oh, see, I hate that, though.
Like, but he was right.
I mean, yeah, he was right, but, like, he didn't have to be.
No, but he was. He was right. But, like, I take it as is that, like, he actually knows her really well. Yeah. And, to me, that's all he was saying. He wasn't, like, making some generalization about how women have to get married or anything like that. He was just like, Joe, I know you, and... you're gonna.
Yeah. Well, when he is in Europe and he runs into Amy, he's, like, whining again that, like, because I think he's, like, not really working on his music and he's just, like, whining and loafing around. And Amy is like, what? You're not even, you know, you have all of this time on your hands and you're not even doing it. And he says, my composition is not like your painting. Mediocre copies of another man's genius.
I thought he said it is like her painting.
No, because she was doing a lot of replica painting.
Yeah.
Or, like, you know, copying other paintings. And what he's saying is that, like, when you write a song, you're not just copying somebody else's music. You're writing your own.
Oh, yeah, that's not what I heard, and that is gross.
Yeah. Yeah. And she also is like, what the fuck? Because he comes on to her then, and she's like, fuck you, man, get out of here.
Yeah.
Which is also great.
And he's like, I'm going to make myself worthy of you, which basically just means he's going to go get a job and make some money.
Yeah.
And, like, be a grown-up. Which, like, that's all she ever really wanted, though. I don't know.
Yeah.
I think she's better than that, but, like, she wanted a rich husband.
Whatever, girls gotta do what a girl's gotta do, I suppose. And then die after giving birth, because we didn't have antibiotics yet.
Well, I'm glad we didn't have to see that part.
Yeah, that would have been really deeply upsetting. So the man that Joe does fall in love with is this Friedrich guy. I guess he's German. She meets him in New York because she goes off to dirty, bustling New York City to be a big-time writer. And you see her get, like, rejected by multiple publications, saying, like, go to a woman's magazine. They'll publish your stuff there. And then she finally does get published, but only with a male pseudonym, which Louisa May Alcott also experienced. She had a difficult time getting published, so she published as a man instead up until Little Women. So she meets this guy when she's in New York, and he says, when I saw you, I knew you were a writer, which I put a side-eye emoji next to that, because that's such a lame pickup line.
But he really did.
Yeah.
And he is also a writer.
Yeah, because she has, like, an inky finger. Yeah. It's just the way he says it. Because also, he is, like, significantly older than she
is. He's a lot older than her, yeah.
Like, he's, like, a grown-ass man with gray hair. And she's still probably maybe 22 at that point.
I looked it up. I don't remember. There's, like, a solid, like, 20-year age gap.
Yeah.
But he encourages her to basically write better. Like to stop writing fluff and to, like, write, like, from her heart for real. And he convinces her that people would actually like that. Which is, like, something that, like, nobody else could have given her. I mean, not, you know, of course they could have, but, like, nobody else who was already in her life could have given her that, you know? Could have given her that piece of wisdom.
Yeah. And I think also, like, she liked having him to, like, bounce ideas off of and stuff. So, like, you see this one scene of her, like, furiously writing and also furiously asking him questions of, like... I wrote one down, which was my favorite. How long would it take strychnine to dissolve in brandy? She, like, needed it for a story, which I think is hilarious.
She says one of my favorite... Well, she says maybe my favorite thing in the movie, when she's, besides drink this good broth, when she's in New York and she's sitting in a room with a bunch of men and they're arguing about whether or not women can vote. And finally they wise up and they ask the woman in the room what she thinks after, like, 3 minutes.
Is the least believable part of the movie, that they actually ask the woman for what she thinks.
So she tells them her argument about why women should be able to vote, and they all agree with her. And they say, you should have been a lawyer. And she says, I should have been a great many things. And I just think that's, like, so real for somebody who is so...
Was born when she was born.
Yeah, so talented, so smart, and she's not allowed to be anything.
Yeah. I don't think this line made it into this movie, but it's in the trailer for the one that's coming out on PBS soon, which is, and I'm pretty sure it's in the book, something to the effect of, like, being born a girl is, like, the worst thing that's ever happened to me.
Yeah, I just watched that trailer.
Yeah.
I just watched that trailer, and none of the lines in it were in the movie, and so I was like, oh, this seems different. Yeah.
Yeah, it does look a little bit different. Looks good. I'm looking forward to it. Angela Lansbury will be playing Aunt March. And the daughter of Uma Thurman and Ethan Hawke will be playing Jo.
Oh, I bet she's beautiful.
She is beautiful. Yeah. Good for her.
What's the other one that's coming out?
The other one. I don't know. It had, like, way less information on there. The one coming to PBS in May It was written and created by the woman who did Call the Midwife, which is a really good show about the lives of women and dying in childbirth, that I had to watch because the childbirth scenes are a little too intense, but it's a very good show. Oh, and Emily Watson will be playing Marmee, the mother. And then another adaptation, that one's going to be like a modern retelling, slated for next year. And the only name attached to that really is Leah Thompson.
Oh, really?
So she'll be playing Marmee.
Oh, I like that.
Should be interesting. Yeah, I like that too. Recently saw her in her first film role in Jaws 3. She plays a water skier.
How is it that she played a mom? Because she played the mom in Back to the Future, right?
I know, which was
how is she
only
supposed
like
a mom then, and she's still a mom now.
Yeah. Well,
that was 30 years ago.
Film roles for women. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's she went
true.
right from water skiing as a beach babe, Jaws 3, to playing a mom in Back to the Future just a couple years later.
I mean, I guess they aged her when she was the mom, and also they mostly used her as her young self. Fine, okay, fine.
Well, speaking of mothers, when Jo comes back from New York because she gets word that Beth is really ill, she's, like, walking up to the house, and Meg is outside, and she's, like, 1,000 months pregnant, and she's like, oh, my God, why didn't you tell me? And she says, oh, one hardly speaks of such things, which is true. Up until very recently, like, people didn't talk about being pregnant because,
really?
Like, yeah, I mean, you could lose a pregnancy at any moment, you could drop dead at any moment, die in childbirth, you know, it was, like, a taboo to, like, talk or, like, get excited.
Even still, you don't talk about it.
Which is really sad.
You don't talk about it for the first trimester.
Yep. It's really sad. Because maybe if we did talk about it, things in women's health wouldn't be so fucked up. But anyway.
I also learned a new word, but I don't remember what it was. Yeah. But it had something to do with Meg being pregnant. I had to Google it. Because after Beth dies, Meg is not there.
Yeah, they say she's taken to her bed or something.
No, but they use there's a word for it.
There was a specific word for it.
I don't remember what it is. I should have written it down.
Meg, bed rest. She's basically on bed rest.
Yeah, because she's about to have the babies.
Right. Which it turns out, whoops, we thought it was going to be one baby. It's actually two.
It was two babies.
Because ultrasound doesn't exist yet.
I can look through my Google search history. Let's see.
Going to find it more quickly. Important term because it, like, women used to go into seclusion, like, towards the end of their pregnancies.
Not sequestration. That was different.
Close.
Close, though. That was a different argument. Googled Samantha Mathis a bunch because she was dating River Phoenix when he died.
Okay.
And I thought that was interesting. I mean, sucky. Like, that's super sucky.
Who's she?
The old version of
older
Amy. Older Amy, yeah.
Okay.
I Googled how much $25 was because that's how
much.
How much
was it?
It was like, it's like $300. It's a lot of money.
Oh, wow. That is a lot. That was like how much the train ticket was, right?
No, yeah, because that's how much Jo made when she cut off her hair. For the train ticket.
Beauty.
I can't find it. It's not here.
We have to know what this word is. God damn it, I will watch the entire thing again just to find it.
Well, you can go back to the, you know which part it is.
Yeah. Doctors are increasingly no longer recommending bed rest due to a variety of bad things that can happen because of bed rest. So it's like one of those things where they're like, I'm sure this is fine. And then it turns out not so much. They're like outside when they say that, right?
I don't know. I don't remember. It's like just after Beth dies and they're...
Yeah.
And they're like saying why everyone can't be there. And it's so sad actually because Jo is like, she says something like, oh no, none of us, we're not all gonna ever be together ever again.
Oh my god, yeah, no, I wrote that down. because I don't know if you've lost anyone like close to you in your family, but there is this moment where you realize that like you're never, well, I guess this is true of like anyone who you lose if you're close to them, like you realize all of a sudden that like you're never going to be together again. Mm-hmm. And that can be really like a super intense moment. I think that's, it's then that she actually like runs out into the woods. Mm-hmm. Too. Yeah. That really struck me. Yeah.
Well, and it kind of illustrates this, like, even if you disregard that Beth has just died, like, I feel like for Joe especially, she has these, like, two conflicting things within her where she, like, really wants to go out and be her own person, and she also just, like, really wants to be with her family.
Yeah.
And, like, I feel like we all have that now. I mean, if you like your family, like, some people are probably like, cool, family, peace, you know? But, like, there's this thing now, especially I feel like where we're all raised to be pretty independent and we leave our families and like often move really far away, and yeah, it's like two conflicting things within you. Yeah. And like Joe
and
really
get
has
that in Beth's like death monologue where she says like, why does everybody have to go away, why do they all want to go away?
Yeah, I am
trying to cue up the part of the movie where they use that word. And who's the old lady that lives with them? Hannah?
I don't know. Is she like,
I thought she was their grandma, but they call her Hannah, so I don't know.
No, I think she's just like their house lady.
Okay.
Because they're not, like, they're poor, but they're not that poor because they still have her, right?
Right. Yeah, I don't know. I just always thought she was their grandma, and then I realized not.
I'm going to ask.
But I'm watching her spread flower petals over Beth's bed belongings.
Yeah. She puts them on the doll, and that's when
I... squeezes the doll's hand.
That's when I ugly cry.
Fun fact, the historical reference for putting flower petals on the bed of somebody who just died is because people would leave their family members' corpses in bed for many days after they die so that the family could come by and see them and say goodbye. And because they didn't have washing machines or refrigeration or anything like that, it would smell. So they would take petals of roses or other very fragrant flowers and put them on their stuff.
We're so lucky.
I know.
Hannah Mullet is their maid and cook.
Okay. Will we never all be together again? Her dad just like walks out of the room silently.
He's like, we're not gonna be together right now.
Running through the woods, and this movie has such a good sense of like just being enveloped by nature, you know. Mm-hmm. Like the natural setting just is so much a part of the movie, and you see the passing of time through the changing of the seasons, which is like one of my favorite things, like in the Great British Baking Show, if you pay attention in the background over the course of a season, you see the flowers change and stuff. It's nice.
I really like, because Joe runs through the woods at least twice. I think she runs a couple other times too. I really like to watch how she holds all of her skirts up as she runs. Yeah.
Louisa May Alcott, huge proponent of running, advocated for women to run, which was a thing that women weren't allowed to do back then. And actually, like, ran regularly up until shortly before her death.
That's great.
Yeah.
What a hero.
Meg has entered her confinement.
Confinement!
She put it in a letter to Lori.
And that's when he learns that Beth has died and he goes to see Amy.
Yeah.
The condition of being in childbirth. Also, the first thing in the definition is dated. Because, yes.
Okay, well, that term was not as interesting as I thought it was.
Another, like, small detail that I really liked was there's a part closer to the beginning where Meg and Joe are about to go out to this party, and they're, like, trying to be all proper, and Meg is, like, teaching Joe how to behave, and one, Joe's dress is burned in the back, which is great. And so she has to spend the whole party, like, standing against the wall, or putting her hands behind her dress to cover it up. And then she ends up spending the whole party in a room with Laurie anyway, just, like, being goofballs, which is, like, exactly how you should spend every party.
Agreed.
But so Meg is, like, trying to teach her the rules, and she's like, you mustn't shake hands. Like, it's not the thing anymore. And then when she goes to New York, the first thing she does is shake the woman's hand of the place she's going to live. Just, like, a small detail. And I was like, oh, all right.
Yeah.
Throw the rules out the window. Your life's different now.
Yeah. Well, no, I think that Joe is somebody who would, like, just always shake a person's hand, you know?
Well, no, the woman offers her hand first.
Oh,
interesting. I think.
Okay. Things are different here in New York City.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's, yeah.
There are a lot of really good details in this movie. And the costumes are so good, and the set dressing is so good. It was actually modeled after Louisa May Alcott's Real House. The, like, evergreen swag and garland that they have all over the house during the Christmas scenes are just to die for. Next year, I'm going to have to make some evergreen garland and hang it about, because it looks so lovely. Oh, and the oranges. That is, like, a really strong image from this movie, because there's the orange in the first Christmas scenes, which are during the Civil War, where they have, like, this one orange, and Amy tries to covet it, but ultimately they bring it to their neighbors who are poorer than they.
They bring all the food to their neighbors. I want that breakfast that they have.
Oh my god, it looks so good, doesn't it?
So good.
Yeah.
The bread is beautiful, and the sausage is beautiful. I don't even like oranges, and the orange is beautiful.
Yeah, it is very picturesque. And recording this, like, a week before Christmas, it's making me hungry for Christmas Day breakfast.
Oranges were, like, a big deal until, like...
Yeah.
Because on Mad Men, whenever Don goes to California, he, like, brings back oranges. Yeah. And that's, like, a big deal.
Well, that actually is a nod to, the heavy, heavy advertising and marketing that the orange industry did during the 20th century. So, check this. I looked deep into the orange thing. Because I knew that it was, like, a Christmas tradition. Like, a lot of times kids, maybe not in the United States in the 21st century, but, like, during the 20th century, and I know in, like, Northern and Central Europe, the orange is a thing, too. Just that, like, kids would, like, get one in their stocking or something. And so prior to, like, rail travel, it was really rare to find citrus fruit in those, like, northern latitudes, because it's just too cold to grow there.
Yeah.
And so, especially during the Civil War, where trade from the southern part of the United States was cut off from the north, like, for them to have an orange in December is, like, a really big deal in this movie. And that's why it, like, Amy was so covetous of it, because it's, like, so valuable. But you actually see the orange later in the movie again when Joe is living in New York City and she's, like, sitting there. I think she's writing a letter home, or maybe it's when she's working on the manuscript for what ultimately is Little Women. And you see her just, like, casually enjoying an orange because it was a lot easier to get oranges after the Civil War, not just because trade had been restored with southern parts of the United States and the boundaries of the United States have been expanded, but also because of rail travel. It was much easier to get oranges from those warmer latitudes to further north. And then in the 20s was when they, like, introduced orange juice, and then that has a whole weird and long and pretty racist history behind
some
it, too.
Some podcast did that story because I've heard orange juice story.
Yeah. It's
and
fascinating.
I don't remember it, really, but yeah. Like, yeah.
Race kind of like pops up in this movie a couple times, which is interesting. Like, Louisa May Alcott's father and the Alcotts in general were like strong abolitionists. Although I feel like I read recently that Bronson Alcott, like, even though compared to the people of his time was very progressive on the issues of race, he was still, by today's standards, like a huge racist. Mm-hmm. So take this with a grain of salt. But, he had written like extensively on the topic of abolition and stuff like that. And when Meg is like getting ready for their coming out party, like during the makeover scene, which I keep almost saying makeout scene, over scene, she's like with all those other girls and they're talking about silk and how they haven't had silk dresses since, you know, before the war broke out. And one of the other girls says some things like, I wrote it down, hang on. Oh, the marches haven't bought silk in years. They have views on slavery.
They have views, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, and in that scene you learn that they also have views on children working.
Yeah.
Which also is very progressive for that time.
Yeah, and the family in general had views on all sorts.
They had
of
a lot of views. That's why they're great.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and Susan Sarandon has that great monologue about how the only reason that like women get faint and, you know, delicate is because we keep them inside.
Yeah,
and they should be out running when around
when they're all playing outside in the snow.
Yeah,
yeah,
really good. Oh, when she finally does write her book, you see her sign her actual name, Joe Marsh, or Josephine Marsh, which is so nice. After, like, knowing that she had been trying to publish or publishing under a man's pseudonym. It's a nice, nice image.
Yeah. And to use her whole name, Josephine, too.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I was wondering, in the scenes where they're, like, putting on plays in their attic and wearing all those costumes, I'm like, how much of my style is actually influenced by this movie? And I just realized. Because they have so many good hats.
They have a, yeah.
Great hats and shawls. I've gotten very into shawls this year. It was a natural progression from blanket scarf. And it's basically just wearing a blanket. I don't understand why we forgot that that's a great idea.
I'm going to do that. That sounds great.
Yeah, highly recommend. Yeah, I think that does it for the movie itself, and then I have lots more trivia.
What else you got? That was like pretty much all my notes on the movie.
Yeah.
I sometimes I'm able to like study the movies we watch, like, and write a lot of notes about them as if I'm like studying the movie, and then sometimes I'm like, I just want to watch the movie. This is one that I like just wanted to watch, so I didn't take
this
that many notes.
This is actually the most notes that I took in a really long time, because I just kept writing down all the things that I loved. So much stuff. And like how... Wait, I haven't even been paying attention to some of these other notes that I made. Oh, the makeover scene. Get out of here, Christian Bale. Oh, Joe has a... Oh my god. I love Josh moment, kind of, when she sees Lori in the doorway kissing somebody else. I'm not even sure who she's kissing. Do you know who that is?
He was kissing somebody?
Yeah, I think so. Or maybe, you know what, it might have actually been her sister and Eric Stoltz instead. But she had this moment of, like, you could see, like, the jealousy in her eyes that kind of reminded me of that scene in Clueless.
Well, they're all very, like, yeah, when, so, like, she catches Meg, making out with Brooks in a doorway.
Okay. Yeah, that's what I was thinking.
But
of.
Meg hasn't, like, announced to the family really yet that they're a thing. And, like, I feel like, so Joe's, like, super pissed off, but I just feel like that's because they're so close that, like, she is gonna hate anybody who tries to come into their family, right. You know?
Yeah.
And then, obviously, she doesn't hate him for very long.
I don't know. It strikes me that she's, like, not that big of a fan of him. She's like, nah. Well, I think she could do better, honestly.
That's kind of what they all think.
Yeah.
And even, like...
Yeah, because he's poor, but he also, like, doesn't seem that great otherwise. Although he treats her right, and they're like, well, at least we got that.
Well, that's, like, fine, really all the mom wants for them.
Yeah, that's true. Joe has a really excellent riding hat. She has a, like, weird kind of Santa Claus-y sort of hat.
It's like, yeah. I feel like there's a hat like that in Clueless also.
Maybe. A lot of good hats in that movie, too. But I need to get myself a hat like that. I'm not a writer, but I do spend late nights at my drawing desk, and I think it would make a nice addition. Oh, Louisa May Alcott actually suffered health problems of her own in her later years and may actually have had lupus. In photographs of her shortly before her death, she actually has a rash on her face, which is fairly characteristic of lupus. So more modern researchers have started to think that that's why she died and not which what had previously... her death had been attributed to, which is mercury poisoning, because she was treated with mercury when trying to survive typhoid after her brief time nursing during the Civil War. Yeah, she was a nurse in a Union Army hospital and then got typhoid and had to leave. While filming, Claire Danes accidentally lit her hair on fire because she was carrying a candle up the stairs, and it caught her hair on fire. Though most of the hair in this movie is actually either wigs or, like, sewn-in hair pieces.
Yeah. It looks good, though.
It looks amazing. The whole time, I thought it was real hair. And I was even thinking, like, oh, man, everyone's hair looks great in this movie.
I only assumed that it was fake because it was, like... So long. And like then yeah. Amy's hair is like so perfect.
Yeah. And then also Susan Sarandon has this like monster braid. It's like really super long, but it's also like very girthy. And I was like, that's gotta be some extra hair in there. Guess who also auditioned for the role of young Amy March?
Who? Wait, I'm going to guess.
Christina Ricci.
Oh, that would have been my guess.
Yeah. But also Natalie Portman.
I like Kirsten Dunst better. Although I think Natalie Portman would have been good.
Yeah, and also I think I read Thora Birch auditioned for her, too.
Yeah.
Ooh, Alicia Silverstone auditioned for the role of Beth.
Nope.
Yeah, she was a
bit older. No one can ugly cry like Claire Danes does in this.
Oh, my God. She is a maestro of the ugly cry.
Does she ugly cry in anything else? I feel like maybe in Romeo and
literally
Juliet.
Literally everything she's ever been
in. What else is she in?
My So-Called Life, right? Where she's crying constantly. I have never seen Homeland, but it is my understanding that there's a lot of ugly crying on that show, too. What else has she been in? Oh, Romeo and Juliet. She definitely ugly cries in that,
yeah. Geez, I really haven't seen a lot of stuff that she's in.
I think she ugly cries in that.
This movie was like, I don't want to say like, had a lot of women crew, but it had more women crew than most other movies.
Yeah, true.
When I read the credits, because I was noticing it in the beginning that like, the director, the screenwriter, and someone else important were all women. Like the main producer, I think. And I was like, okay, yeah, all right. And like, I was like, what about everybody else? So I like, purposely read the credits at the end, and there is a bunch of women in there.
Yeah. Yeah, the production designer, art director, and Cedrus are all men, though. But they did do a fantastic job.
And the editor was a man, which is, I mean, editors are, is a woman's job. I mean, it's not, you know, anyone can be an editor. But, like, a lot of editors are women. Yeah. So I was surprised when it was a man.
Huh. I don't know if I'm familiar with that generalization.
Yeah, it's kind of a thing. I mean, I think, like, more than other jobs. Like, that's been one that women have been able to break into and actually, like, have been well-respected at doing.
Yeah, that
you know?
Makes sense. Well, something that I was thinking about when I was looking at who the director and screenwriter and stuff were, the director, I was like, why hasn't she... Because she is Australian, but she's only made, like, a handful of other movies, and they're all, like, weird Australian movies. And I was like, why hasn't she worked more? And then I start to wonder, like, why hasn't she worked more, you know, given what we know now about women in Hollywood?
Yeah.
Because this is, like, a very good movie. It was well reviewed at the time. It has, like, a really good score on Rotten Tomatoes and stuff. This is, like, a capital G, capital M, good movie.
This is a good movie.
And, like, how has she not directed more things? I would like to see more things directed by her. But anyway.
Well, I wonder how common it is for a person, man or woman, to make one movie and then make a bunch of other movies that aren't as good. Or, like, aren't as known. Like, that also might be a thing.
That never happens.
No, never mind.
No, I'm kidding. Yeah, no, I think that's a fair point. But... you know, it would seem that she hasn't gotten a lot of good opportunities,
right.
You know. I feel like I took more notes than this, but apparently I did not. That's it.
I just, like, then if we're, like, near the end, I want to say, like, how important I think it is that, like, all little girls watch this movie.
Yeah.
Or why? any version of it, or read it, or whatever. But, like, it's so important for girls to see girls together like this, behaving this way.
Yeah.
I mean, and it's sad that, like, something written in... What year was this written?
The book?
Yeah.
1868.
So, like, it's kind of sad that, like, something written in 1868 you could still read and be like, still kind of relevant.
Yeah.
Like, obviously we've come a long way, but in a lot of ways we haven't. Yeah, I think it's important for girls to see other girls like this, although they are very white.
Yeah.
And I can recognize that. It's a very white story.
Well, rural New Hampshire, I think it is.
Massachusetts.
1860s. Yeah. Not a bustling hub of multiculturalism.
No, apparently not.
I need to, like, read a lot more about Louisa May Alcott, though.
I was
interested in her.
And she's from Massachusetts, and I'm like, oh, maybe I should just, like, go to her house. Like, I bet they have a bunch of stuff.
When it's warmer out, we could take a field trip. A really long field trip.
Yeah.
And go visit her house, because I would love to see it. Apparently, when she was hospitalized with typhoid, she wrote this compilation of... she wrote these letters that she sent home over the course of 6 weeks, and they were published as this thing called Hospital Sketches, and I really want to read them. It sounds really interesting. And also makes me wonder, like, how different is that than being hospitalized now?
Yeah.
I mean, obviously very different, but also at the same time, kind of probably not that different. I will say, watching this now for the first time as an adult, where, like, I've had a lot more health issues, I always kind of identified with the character of Beth, because she's, like, the sickly one that can't go outside a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sick a lot as a kid, and there's, like, not a lot of representations of sick kids outside of, like, Victorian literature.
Mm-hmm.
But this time around, it was, like, especially gutting to watch her kind of character arc.
Yeah.
Really sad.
But she, it seems like, and, like, maybe it's just because she was kind of sickly, but she isn't upset by it.
Yeah. Well, and her monologue about death is, I find, fascinating. Because she said, like, you guys were always, like, off making plans and, like, I don't know, just, like, wasn't for me.
Yeah.
I like to stay home.
Yeah.
I'm not afraid of death. It's coming. It all is. Like, it's coming for all of us. You know? Yeah. Really interesting to hear her say that. Well, good thing I brought down the room right before the end of the podcast. My specialty.
Well, then I'll tell you that I learned that you can visit Louisa May Alcott's Orchard House, also known as the Little Women House, and take a tour of it for $10. And they do a Little Women Christmas there.
Oh, wow.
I don't know what that entails, but who cares?
Yeah. Because that has me wondering, like, oh, does that mean that, like, it's, like, extra good to go during Christmas and, like, be that cold, or would it be a total letdown? Hard to say. I forgot that this is, like, kind of a Christmas movie.
Yeah, I wouldn't really think of it that way, although parts of it do center around Christmas.
Yeah. Well, because it marks the passage of time with two Christmases.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it opens during Christmas, and then the first part of it ends after that second Christmas.
Mm-hmm.
So, Christmas does center pretty largely, I think.
Mm-hmm. Did we do it? Did we do Little Women?
I think we did it. Yeah. Sure. So, well, I mean, that does it for the last episode of Wishful Thinking for 2017. I think that's pretty exciting.
Super exciting. The first year of our podcast, but not really a year because it didn't start until June.
June? Really? I thought it was before that.
Maybe. I don't remember.
Well, listeners, if you want to go back and listen to older episodes of the Wishful Thinking podcast, you can find them on Apple Podcasts and Google Play and all the places that you get podcasts, and also at cageclub.me. cageclub.me. That is the home of the Cage Club Podcast Network, on which this podcast resides. And there's lots of other good podcasts there. Some new ones. They got one about Charlize Theron now. They got one about Channing Tatum.
They got one about Fast and Furious.
Fast and the Furious. Also, there's the Philip Seymour Hoffman one, and of course, the classics, Keanu Club, Cage Club, Cinemakers, they're talking about directors. So, there's more. There's more to it that I'm not remembering at the moment. So go to cageclub.me and find out all about them.
Joey's going to make fun of that roundup.
Yeah, he is. Yes, he is. What's up, Joey?
We did our best, Joey.
We're trying here. Follow us on social media at InSicknessPod. Send us an email.
We are not at InSicknessPod.
You're right. That's my other podcast. Listen to my other podcast, InSickness and InHealth. Yeah. No, I've just said that so many times is what automatically comes out of my mouth. What is our social media, Jordan?
at WistfulPod.
Wistful Pod.
On Twitter, Instagram, and you can find us on Facebook.
Yeah. WistfulPod@gmail.com, I think is our email address.
Yeah.
Send us an email. Tell us what you think. Was Little Women important to you in your life? If not, what was? What do you want to see us do on future episodes of the podcast? Do you want to be
on the podcast?
On the podcast. That was the phrase I was looking for. Drop us a line.
Bye.